Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer a few nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though sometimes it feels counterintuitive, like the nightingale, a bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist. Lovely to have you join me today for a pretty special chat with a husband and wife team, Vanessa and Nicholas Pete. Vanessa is a nutritionist and personal trainer who suffered with eating disorders when she was younger, while Nicholas is a qualified GP who had to overcome his own health issues in the form of Crohn's disease. And they both identify as neurodiverse. And one of their specialist areas is helping parents to work out if their child is neurodiverse and not just a picky eater or difficult, as well as helping parents manage the condition. And this can be incredibly stressful, especially at this time of year as the festive season gets well underway. And talking of stress, just let me take a moment to remind you that a great way to de-stress is to book an energy session with me. You can find out more details at my website, safehavenhealing.uk, and book an initial consultation. It's really helpful if you need to step away from the madness and recharge. Now, speaking with Nicholas and Vanessa, I was fascinated to learn about neurodivergence and the correlation with selective eating, which can be hugely disruptive within families. It did give me a bit of an aha moment as it explained my own father's eating foibles, because although he was never diagnosed, I am pretty sure he was dyslexic. Here's Nicholas, who I asked to explain the correlation between the two.
Neurodivergence, I mean, the first thing I think you need to define it. Mm. What is it? What does it mean to be neurodivergent? The first is, if you have a typical mind, the average mind, the neurodivergent one differs from it. Mm. So it doesn't run in the same way in which we'd expect the average mind to work. That's all it means. And that could take any form or shape. You know, the dyslexic mind or the Asperger's mind, etc., ADHD minds. So that's what it means by neurodivergent. It functions in a different way in society or educationally, for example. And when we think about selective eating and neurodivergence, we have a degree of correlation between those two things, because persons who have neurodivergence have an increased prevalence of selective eating and problems associated with selective eating.
It's so interesting to me because for years, my father wasn't diagnosed as dyslexic, but looking back over the years, I can see that he probably was. And he was very particular about food. And it just struck me, oh, okay, now I know. Now, yeah, it all makes sense that he was dyslexic. Didn't stop him getting on in life. You know, he did very well. But he did have very particular choices about food. He didn't like green stuff much, apart from asparagus. You know, he really was a meat and potatoes man, but he was Scottish. So, yeah, that you can understand that. But I remember somebody saying to me once, oh, you know, I was looking after my aged parents and they said, oh, great, you can give them some healthy food. And I said, no, that ain't going to work. Partly because they were very, you know, he was very fixed in his ways about food and knew what he liked. So tell me a little bit about, because you have experience, you have direct experience of this, don't you? So maybe Vanessa, you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I think it will be a lovely opportunity to just give a bit of background of my neurodiverse background. So I have a diagnosis of dyspraxia, dyslexia and visual stress. And I was only diagnosed in my very early 20s as being dyslexic. And sadly, at that time, there was a misdiagnosis of dyspraxia, which I'm predominantly dyspraxic and mildly dyslexic. And therefore, I went through all of my, early years straight through into secondary school and then later into university without this diagnosis of neurodiversity. And, you know, I can really connect with what you've shared there from what you've mentioned with relation to your father, just speaking with other families with dyslexic children and just hearing the challenges that they face with different textures of different foods, often wanting to engage with repetition of certain things that they really, really enjoy. And this is something that you hear really, really commonly and sometimes really throws up a lot of challenges for families around meal times and things in relation to the simplicity of going out for a meal, which some people may take for granted. For neurodiverse families can become quite a challenge.
I can see that that might be. And then, of course, you've got the response from other people around you. If you're going out for a meal, it's like, why on earth can't that child eat just normally? You know, you've got all that to deal with as well, haven't you? But explain to me, you have also, you know, you've got an entire family, let's just say, where you have all these issues. So give me an idea of how you deal with it, what the issues are within your family and how you deal with it.
I think what's really interesting is that in the early stages, we didn't have full clarity around our neurodiversity as a family as well. So Nicholas received his diagnosis. Do you want to share a little bit on that? Because I think that segues.
Age 38.
That's it.
Age 38, did you say? Yes.
So quite late on. When I think back in terms of my own childhood, you know, I had specific things that I just wouldn't tolerate. Dry, all my food had to be dry. It didn't have any gravy on it whatsoever. Even if it was difficult to swallow, it had to be dry. And then there were certain things that it wouldn't tolerate, like onions and things like that. So, and the separation of foods, things wouldn't touch things on the plate. So there were those specific things in my childhood that, quite frankly, weren't really acknowledged by my parents as being anything significant. The isolation I had as a teenager wasn't really identified. Some fiery emotions and breakout of emotions was just Nicholas's personality. So these things were missed in the early years. So when we're thinking about excessive eating, not to say that, look, there's going to be neurodiversity with it, because most children go through a degree of selective eating anyhow. It's part of normal development. And so we don't want to label everyone, oh, if you've got selective eating, you must have some sort of neurodivergence. That's absolutely not the case. Most children by 5 or 6, or perhaps a little bit older, will move away from their selective eating and be more accepting of it. It doesn't mean that there's not stress for the parents. It doesn't mean it's not difficult around meal times, all the things we discussed already. And so support is still needed for parents, how to recognize when those eating disorder or those eating difficulties or selective eating could be difficult, that could relate to a disordered form of eating, like disordered eating. And when it goes into a diagnostic phase, when it needs a lot more support and care. So, dealing with it in our own lives, with our own children, really had to encompass, you know, trying to get it right, not making mistakes, because sometimes parents make mistakes with their children. They may label them fussy eaters, for example. That labeling of a child, that psychology that you're giving to that child, that they're a bother, that they don't engage with their family, that they are fussy, that they're not easy to deal with, that just promotes the same sort of behavior. So we can't label them fussy. We have to say, this is a selective eater. They select what they want to choose, and that's okay. Having a more relaxed approach to it rather than a emotional response to it, normalizing the process is very important to support a child with selective eating. And so there are many things that we could do. I could babble on about it, but I'll pause there and give Vanessa a try.
Yes. So I'd love to come in just from, the angle as a wife and also as a mother.
Yeah.
Because when we began our journey, I was therefore, you know, presented with these requirements around dietary needs, which I then had to kind of adapt for within my cooking styles. And also in terms of our son, who showed very similar traits to his dad in terms of his requirement for food, being placed on the plate in a particular location, having, you know, certain preferences about certain things, and therefore really needing to have those applied practical skills in terms of not making a fuss, as Nicholas has said, and really kind of encouraging different varieties, even when those different varieties may not be accepted, but instead still making those different presentations, and actually just seeing the journey over time of, you know, being able to accept and be willing to try different things that, you know, maybe over and over again, you know, our son may have said no to, but with time became quite open. And there's a real transition in our lives with going out with a friend, so not with family, and went out on a lovely afternoon and a restaurant, which he had previously said no to on numerous occasions. He went out with friends. He tried something different while he was out for that meal. And all of a sudden, he was open to going to this particular location. And we've just seen such growth. And it's really kind of encouraged us to really empower and encourage others that change will come. It is slow and it does take time, but it does come into being over time.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, what I'm hearing from you is that the old fashioned approach of you have to eat everything on your plate or else really doesn't work. And it's not helpful to just condemn the child as a picky eater, because it's not just a willful thing. It's something that's in them that they can't help. But that with patience, you can move on from that that position, and the child can become more accepting, more tolerant. And I'm just thinking, you know, in many households, probably, I don't know, but probably, you've got a lot of mothers telling children to eat what's in front of them, and there being a huge tantrum. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you might experience?
I think you've just touched on something that I was literally just thinking about while you were reflecting and sharing with us. And it's just around exactly as you're describing, that background around being told that you have to eat everything on your plate. Mm. And it was only through my own nutritional journey that I became aware of the concept of being pleasantly full. Which is very, very different from finishing everything on your plate.
Yeah.
And really encouraging children, adults and individual to eat until they're pleasantly full. And that doesn't always encompass finishing everything that's on your plate. It's actually understanding what that place of pleasantly full feels like for you as an individual.
And the evidence shows actually that children are excellent regulators, self-regulators of nutritional need. And the evidence also shows that toddlers who are selective eaters, on average, will meet all of their nutritional needs. Despite being picky, they will usually have a diverse enough diet to manage it, even despite the selective eating. So parents definitely shouldn't worry, shouldn't panic. And we should appreciate that the nation needs to appreciate the fact, acknowledge the fact that we have to be pleasantly full and make sure that we're not overeating. Sometimes we overeat because of the joy of eating, or the environment that we're in, or the serving that we're served. But it really has to be a cultural, and starting with family, but also a cultural change. Because quite frankly, overeating, eating that little extra, finishing your plate all the time, is one of the things that promotes obesity. And we're living in an obesogenic society at the moment, and we need to pull that back. And one of the things is for us to be more sensitive to our calorie intake at the dining table.
Well, it's time to take a short break right now, but stay tuned for more on this fascinating subject with Nicholas and Vanessa Peet after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and my guests this week, Nicholas and Vanessa Peat. Now, before the break, we were talking about how we eat, and I was curious to hear whether they thought what you eat is as important, given that my mantra is eat as fresh and unprocessed a diet as possible. Here's Nicholas again.
Well, it does in many respects, particularly when you think about selective eating and your diversity. Mm. There have been small studies and probably large studies that have shown children often memorize the adverts from fast food chains and the high fat, high sugar. So when you have that eat well plate, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the eat well plate, where you've got a bit of protein, bit of a carbohydrate, et cetera, and in the section where it's sweets and sugar and fat, all the adverts that the kids remember just fit into that category. We also find that children are more likely to consume or overconsume ultra-processed foods that are high in sugar and fat because it releases a lot of dopamine into their system. And as some of you listeners might know, dopamine, there could be dopamine resistance in someone who has neurodiversity and low levels of dopamine. And so that dopamine kick really just stimulates that part of the brain and therefore is sought out more readily in the diet. And so selective eaters, parents might worry the fact that they always want McCain chicken nuggets, for example, or French fries or chips from McDonald's, for example. So it does play a role, yes.
So how do you get around that? And also, as we're talking, I'm thinking, I prefer my food in a certain way. I'm an adventurous eater. I love Asian food. I love all kinds of different food. But growing up, your meat and two veg, and that was necessarily a thing, but that kind of idea, I would always like everything separately on my plate. I didn't like things just piled on. I would never pile up a fork with everything. Some people put lots of different bits of food on their fork and eat it all at once. I can't do that. I have to eat one thing at a time. Maybe I'm, kind of getting there with my picky eating, but I'm not a picky eater as such. I just prefer, I have preferences, I would say. So how do you tell the difference between somebody like me who has preferences in the way I eat my food and somebody who is a selective eater, and that is something that needs to be paid attention to? What I mean is, it's something that you want to make a diagnosis of or maybe speak to somebody about and see if there is a diagnosis there.
Yes. I mean, it all comes down to the nutrition. Yeah, mm-hmm. It comes down to the diversity of nutrition. So whilst you might have some peculiarity about how your food is prepared or presented, that's absolutely fine. But do you have a diverse diet? And if the answer is yes, then that's absolutely fine. The issue comes in terms of the diversity of the diet, the nutritional requirement. And so for a parent, it's quite obvious if your child is missing out all the time, really healthy foods. Mm-hmm. They never have any vegetables. They always want chicken nuggets. They always want French fries. They always want this or that. And it's never anything else. They won't deviate. They have only five foods that they eat. Clearly, that's a problem, right?
Right.
So when you're dealing with that, there's a clear issue, and it becomes more of an issue when, we have children who are stunting their growth because of that, where their weight is not increasing, or if they're losing weight, that's significant. If they're not achieving their statural height appropriate for their age, that is a real big concern. And then if that is the case, then they might meet the criteria for avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, or ARFID, which is a psychiatric diagnosis for children who have not just selective eating, but have this RFID diagnosis. So we find that with children who have autism, found that almost 70, there's been studies that show that almost 70% of children with RFID and autism had deficiencies in their vitamin C levels, and also deficiencies in their vitamin A levels, and that's associated with eye disease. So children are walking around with scurvy, you know, a condition that used to be of sailors, vitamin D deficiency in a area, in a society that is vitamin C rich. They are suffering with vitamin C deficiency and other micronutrient deficiencies like vitamin D, vitamin B12, for example, and also thiamine as well. So when that is the case, it's really important that you seek medical attention because that requires blood investigations, referral to eating disorders team, and lots of help and support. Outside of that, where there's not a loss of weight, where there's not the stunting of growth stature, it's about supporting the parents in terms of how they can help their child through their selective eating, what they can do at the dining table, what they can do in terms of planning, what they can do in terms of involving the child in terms of cooking and eating, and what strategies a parent can put in place to help. And you kind of asked the question about that earlier in terms of how do you move them away from one food group to another. So, for example, from a French fry from McDonald's to, say, mashed potato, two different foods made of the same thing. And you can do a process, or parents can do a process called chaining. So I'm not sure if you want to explain that, Vanessa.
Yeah, please do, Vanessa, yeah.
Yeah, lovely. So, yeah, when we're thinking about food chaining, a child may really love a particular food. So let's just take, for example, they really, really love McDonald's chips. So they love this food. We're not going to be able to take them straight to mashed potato, but what we could do is we could give them some of their favorite chips from McDonald's, and we could then have some chips from another fast food restaurant. So that could be Burger King or KFC. And as you may know, the differences are, you know, subtle, but there is a difference between those different restaurants.
Yeah, haven't eaten at any of them for a long time.
you get my drift, right?
Yeah,
you
get my absolutely.
Drift. Okay. And then you kind of moved into a place now where the child's accepted the subtle differences between these different fries from different restaurants. And then you could then start another subtle change. And that's where you would take chips from a packet, so such as McCain's or another brand. And then you would then mix those with those fries. But you would have less of the fries and a little bit more of the packeted ones from, you know, the supermarket. And you would gradually kind of accustomize the child to, you know, this mix and this blend that they're having. The next step would be, you know, making some changes and doing some homemade fries where you'll be using your own potatoes, slicing those up and then popping those into the oven. And you'd then be using the packeted fries with the homemade fries and kind of acclimatizing to that blend. And gradually your kind of end result would be kind of then moving on to having more of the homemade chips. And then if we're kind of thinking further on down the line, how do we get to mashed potato?
So yeah, you might that's what I'm thinking.
That is it.
It's a very different texture. It's a very, very different texture.
That's right. And from the homemade chips, you would then go from something like your potato shapes. And this would maybe be involving the child in that process of creating some of these potato shapes that they may get involved in. So they're getting used to that slight change of texture. And you could then try maybe having the roasting of potatoes and then moving on to the mashing of potatoes. So you can see it's a really, yeah, really, really gradual process. And I think sometimes where the challenge can come is when we want to make the transition too quickly between those stages. Because if you think about how long it could take a child to go through each of these stages, it could be quite a lengthy process. But it's for parents to really kind of feel encouraged with each step that the child's going through, and really sticking with the process, keeping that long-term vision of where they'd like to get to. But at the same time, rather than fixating and wanting to get there too quickly, really kind of going step by step and appreciating the progress that the child is making at each stage.
Yeah, that praise that you give the child at each subtle change, it might seem very basic for us as adults, but it's a big change for the child.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also about involving the child, you know, like when it comes down to making the homemade chips, mm-hmm. involving the child in that process, getting them in the kitchen. Sometimes depending on the age of the child, you can also make games out of food to divorce the food from the dining table and the stress of the dining table to a fun thing, mm-hmm. like make, if the child is happy to make necklaces out of pasta pieces, for example, or playing a restaurant sort of style of preparing food for a family, for example. So in any way you can get enjoyment or fun out of food, it helps the child have a better relationship with that food. So that's good. Mm-hmm. The other thing that sometimes children get hooked on is like brands. Mm-hmm. And so we recommend that patients don't just stick with one brand. It's important that you cycle your brands, move through them so they don't get transfixed on one brand. Other things that we can do to try and help with this is using a table, for example, where you, let's say the child loves the chicken nugget, for example. On the top of the table, you'd say, well, what are the characteristics? And it's important that we appreciate characteristics of food. So the chicken nugget, the color is like yellow or brown. The taste is fairly blandish. The texture is crisp, soft, and maybe a bit chewy. The shape's oval. The temperature is hot. The brand is McNugget. And the kind of food is breaded chicken. So the next step for the parent will be thinking, well, what other foods could I introduce to my child that's similar to the chicken nugget? And they might think about, a fish finger, for example. Mm. So a fish finger has the same color. It's got a similar sort of smell and taste, roughly, you know. It's got a similar texture. Fine, it's not oval. It's a bit long, but who cares? there's got to be some difference. Yeah. It has the same temperature, so it's served hot. The brand might be the same or different. And the type of food, well, it's the same sort of food. It comes from the freezer, you put in the oven and eat it. So there you have a similar food. And by doing that for several foods, you can help clear up or make it clear what sort of plan you have that you can try and encourage your child to explore new foods in that sort of way. Another way in which you can help as well in terms of writing things down or jotting things down on a piece of paper and planning how you're going to help your child is by appreciating what foods they really like, what they sometimes like, and what they really dislike. And you can put that in a table of a happy face, an indifferent face, and a sad face, and then put their foods that they really like on one side, and then under the column that you don't have any real, they're very indifferent about, you can put their other foods, and then ones they dislike, and another one. And then when you want to present foods, you may say to the child, in order to encourage them to be more accepting of the thing that they're a little bit indifferent about, or, you know, sometimes say yes to and sometimes says no to, you can give them the option between the thing that they absolutely dislike and the thing that they sometimes do like, and that's the only option available. And when that's the only option, they're more likely to choose the one that they prefer, which is the middle one, rather than the one that they dislike. So for example, it might be they love chicken nuggets, they are okay with fish fingers, and they absolutely hate mince. Well, on one day you might say, we're out of chicken nuggets today, you've got fish fingers or mince, which one do you want? And then of course they're more likely to choose fish fingers. So using these sorts of strategies can be helpful in a simple way to try and encourage your child to explore new foods.
And just to add to that as well, just thinking about the parent who might be thinking, well, my child's just absolutely not going to accept fish fingers because of the shape, or they're not going to accept the turkey dinosaur because it's the shape of the dinosaur. And just thinking about ways that parents can be supportive in being a bit more creative. So, for example, if a child's really, really fixated on shape, one way that we could get around that would be to use, let's say, for example, we wanted to, you know, get the cod fillet to, you know, mirror the chicken nuggets more. We could take some cod fish ourselves and turn it into a circle and then cover that with a breaded surface. And that's such a subtle change, but just the shape being identical to the chicken nuggets, or the turkey, for example, being the same as the chicken nuggets, takes that shape barrier out, because it's like, this is the same shape. And it's kind of really supporting parents in thinking about ways that we can subtly make these changes, which are going to help them to be more accepting to things, and just praising again, which we came back, really celebrating really subtle changes that are embraced.
Yes, and that'll work for anyone, any child, no matter what level they're at or where they are on the spectrum. That's really helpful, isn't it? Well, there's more very useful advice coming up from Vanessa and Nicholas Pete, but first it's time for another short commercial break. Back right after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
And you're still listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist, talking today with Vanessa and Nicholas Pete about neurodivergence and eating. Now, we've just heard about the correlation between the two and some ways of handling that within a family setting. But most of us have preferences, and there will be foods that we really don't like. We just don't like them. Now, there's often an association involved. With me, my bête noire is jam sandwiches made with butter. I was given this at infant school one lunchtime and was promptly very sick. I haven't been able to face the combination of jam or jelly, as they say in North America, butter and bread since. So I wanted to know how parents might handle that. Here's Vanessa again.
It's very interesting that you mentioned that, because I had a previous experience many years ago with couscous when I was first introduced to couscous. That was delivered to me in a way that wasn't very palatable, and therefore has always, hasn't it, risen a bit of a challenge for me when it comes to couscous. And I think it really comes back to, when we're dealing with children, if there are those associations with things, not overly fixating about the thing that they're unwilling to have, because sometimes that can happen. We become fixated on that one thing. And just thinking about, as Nicholas was saying earlier on, the eat well plate, and just thinking about the whole overall diet, and just thinking about, you know, for example, are they gaining that nutrient from other foods?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are. Okay, then that's fine. We can let that go. So really kind of looking at the bigger picture of things and really working out, you know, how critical is this? And then also being creative. Sometimes if it is a nutrient that we really need to get into the diet, then it may be necessary to think of more creative ways that we could maybe blend that food into a recipe that's being made. And having that creative thought rather than that one dimensional, this is how it would usually be done. Sometimes we need to change that view.
Yeah. And also there's the value of multivitamin, you know.
Yes.
You know, good old multivitamin for a child is useful to support, particularly if they're a selective eater. Mm-hmm. You know, our mothers used to give us called liver oil.
I remember it.
But I certainly got that. They have it in all ways now. You can get these in general, you know, in so many different ways. So making sure you're giving your child those essential fish oils, the vitamin D, and the multivitamin will also support the diet, and if there's nutritional deficiencies, again, we'll give some degree of reassurance to parents.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I remember, I've said this before on this show, I remember, yes, I was given cod liver oil as a child, and I was given something disgusting called Scott's Emulsion, which I don't think exists anymore, but it was an emulsion of cod liver oil. Moving on from that. Also, rosehip syrup, because post-war, a lot of kids were deficient in minerals, and you could buy rosehip syrup from the chemists, actually. And I remember I used to have that every day as well as a source of vitamin C, as well as vitamin C tablets and things like that. So, I mean, and yeah, I think it's important to make sure that your children are getting enough nutrition at any stage and in any way. But now I'm thinking, okay, so it kind of sounds like a bit of work for the parents, right? Bit of work. So now we're approaching Christmas. And we, many of us, have family around. You have a whole house full. How do you cope at that time? If you're the hostess, if you're the host and hostess, how do you cook? You know, if you two are cooking Christmas lunch or Christmas dinner, how do you cope with it?
There's a variety of ways to approach this. And when I think about this for families who may be traveling to family, one helpful tip would be to encourage them to remember something that their child may enjoy to take along, so that they can have that home from home feeling while they're away. Also, having children central and involved in the food preparation, shopping choices that are being made during that season, rather than kind of keeping them, you know, isolated away, playing and occupied, really kind of get them involved and integrated into what's taking place. And I feel it's also really important around the self-talk that is happening for the child and for the family as well. Just ensuring that there's a real positive conversation that's taking place. Families are often aware when there's selective eating, and making sure that the conversations that are being had are positive around the child is really, really important. And I would even say going an extra step as well, if conversations aren't or going in the wrong direction, then actually even removing that child from that surrounding to make sure that they're not negatively impacted by a conversation that could cause things to progressively get worse at a later date.
And by what do you mean by that, Vanessa? What give us an example of what that might be?
You know, it may be, you know, I'm feeling tender now, because if you're sitting around a table with loved ones, maybe it's aunties or uncle or close friends, and they were to make a comment that wasn't so positive, it's trying to, you know, turn that around in a more positive way. But if things aren't moving in the right trajectory that you would like it to, you might actually say to your child, okay, I think it's time for us to X, Y, and Z, and so, changing the dynamic of things.
Yeah, so you mean if somebody starts criticizing the child or something like that, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Or making comments about, you know, in my day, we were told to eat or, you know, starve. Yeah. Okay. I understand what you're talking about now. So, yeah. And then, but if you're the one making the meal, if you're the one in the kitchen, how do you make a feast, a Christmas feast for everybody that will satisfy everybody? I mean, I guess people at Christmas have that to contend with in a small way anyway, because you've always got people who are coming along who don't like this and don't like that, and, you know, don't like Christmas pudding, don't like this. No, we're going to have that for the people who don't like that. So I guess there's a bit of that anyway.
That's right. I think it's really important as well, understanding, like you said, different individuals' preferences, and maybe having different things that different people enjoy on the table.
Yeah.
And that may involve some things that a child may really enjoy, but other things that they're less kind of, you know, excited about. But like Nicholas was, you know, describing before, likes, indifference, dislikes, you know, not isolating foods, not thinking, well, they really dislike that, so I'm the host, so I won't prepare those foods, because actually there's some real benefit that comes from those foods, even just being on the table. Sometimes as parents, we may think, well, there's no point of having that because they're not going to eat it. Mm. But actually, that's part of their journey. That food, just being able to be on the table, is really, really powerful.
It's part of good modelling. We have to show our children what it's like to eat well. We have to make sure we're sitting around the dining table with our children in a calm, peaceable way, and allowing your child to be relaxed in that environment, even though they're having that degree of restriction. As you say, presenting all those foods there, the things that they like and things they're indifferent about and things that they don't like, it's more than appropriate to do so. And it's also important to get that child also perhaps even preparing those food that they're indifferent about or don't like that much, because they're more likely to perhaps want to try their food. But again, no pressure to try the food that you prepared for the family. That's okay. And then when they see the family really enjoying the food that they have prepared, they're much more likely to want to maybe have that themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So it's about good modelling.
I think that's
Christmas and the rest of the year.
The rest of the year. I mean, one of the issues I think for a lot of families right now is you don't sit around a table anymore and eat. Mm-hmm. So you would presumably say that is a good habit to get into, and to actually get together, sit around a table, have good food and be able to model enjoying good food that perhaps the child has turned their nose up at in the past. And yeah, they might sort of say, oh, well, maybe I will try that then since they seem to like it so much. Yeah,
absolutely. And just coming back to what you mentioned there around sitting around a table, and just thinking about what other positive things can happen around that environment. So we've got food and we're trying different things, but just in terms of being together, reflecting on your day, thinking about what's gone well today, what's gone well this week, and really kind of thinking about different things that you've learned, celebrating that. And therefore, it becomes less focused around just the meal that you're eating, but also hearing the wonderful things that are going on in each other's lives and really kind of pausing from devices, from the telly, from the phone, from whatever the distractions may be, to be completely present in that moment, to be together, and just really, you know, using those opportunities as real, you know, memorable moments, you know, not to be just thought about with little thought, but really given, you know, that real special time.
Yes, it's I think it's so important. And also to remember that, you know, sometimes these things really do take time. And I'm just thinking about my own food journey. It took me years, decades, to get round to being able to eat mint sauce with lamb. I couldn't bear it. And then suddenly I just thought, oh, I'll give it a go. Oh, that's not too bad, actually. But I couldn't bear the idea of it. Still can't do cranberry sauce. Still cannot do that. But then, you know, I don't eat turkey or chicken or anything like that now anyway. But no, still haven't been able to get my head around that at all. But, you know, even I don't know how neurodivergent I might be. Some people have said that I'm probably on the spectrum somewhere. I don't know. But, you know, if somebody like me can change just, you know, after decades of not eating something. But see, in my case, I think partly it's down to not being given that on the table when we were eating when I was a child. So that was never an option when I was a child. I just wasn't, I just didn't know about it, hadn't eaten it as a child. And so in adulthood, I was avoiding it until I suddenly decided, well, maybe I'll just try it and see, it can't be that bad. And of course, there are some mint sauces that are better than others, but it's a fascinating thing around food. And if you're not shown good food or healthy food or a variety of food early on, then it really can last late into life. So that's just a sort of minor example of it that just took me to when you were talking there. But I can absolutely see the importance and sitting around a table. We always sat around the table when I was a kid. Always. Nobody does seem to do that right now. It's really quite sad. But anyway, enough of my rambling there. I want to hear If people want to find out more about you, because we're coming to the end now, if people want to find more about you and your work, where do they go?
Well, you can find us on all the usual channels like Instagram and LinkedIn, but specifically, you can go to www.ucunutrition.com and then /selective eating. So that's www.ucunutrition.com/selective eating.
Brilliant. And is there a lot of information there that people can use and, you know, dip into?
Yeah, there is information on the website which people can dip and use. And of course, they can always give us a call on 01604-320-346, because we are more than happy to talk to anyone on the phone, giving a little bit of advice or pointing in the right way. But in addition to that, we also have programs available for people, for educational programs for parents, by which they can gain information about some of the things that we've spoken about in much more detail. They can also have one-to-one consultations to get refined information that's unique to them and their situation. We also have information on meal preps and tips and tricks that you can do, and also access to our selective eating community, where you can get support and ongoing help, because oftentimes the dining table and this problem, your kitchen table, can be an isolating place. And who do you talk to about it? Yeah. Who else is going through these difficulties? So having a community that you can engage with, you get some support with, touch base with, ask a question into, then, you know, that's what we provide.
That's a really big point, which we haven't really been able to delve into. But in terms of the parents themselves, having the support that they need yeah. on the journey to make sure that they feel equipped, and also them not feeling that they are not parenting correctly. If
so, big a point, yeah. Well, thank you for making that point. It is really important. And thank you for the work that you do. I think it's fantastic that you are offering that support to people in this situation. So thank you both very much indeed. And I hope that you have a great Christmas as well.
Enjoy the holidays.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You know, I can't tell you how often I've seen parents beating themselves up and thinking that they're bad parents because their children won't conform to someone else's standards when it comes to what they should be eating and how they should eat. Maybe that's why Vanessa and Nicholas's business is called Uniquely Created You. You'll find out all about it at ucunutrition.com, so do take a look. That's ucunutrition.com, and check out some more tips, and maybe give yourself a bit of time ahead of Christmas and New Year to prepare for a much less stressful time than you might have envisaged for yourself. You'll find a couple of tracks that will help you de-stress, if that's what you need, on my website, thepracticalalchemist.uk. Remember to subscribe for updates while you're there. And of course, if you'd like to go deeper, do head over to safehavenhealing.uk and let's you and I talk. You can also follow me as The Practical Alchemist on Facebook and Instagram. And that just about wraps it up for today's show. I found talking with Vanessa and Nicholas Pete really interesting, and I hope you did too. Thank you for listening. Join me next time for more Alchemy 101. Until then, it's goodbye from me and the Nightingale.